So the last two mindfulnesses, or the four mindfulnesses, are mindfulness of the divine body and mindfulness of the view of emptiness. And this gets specifically at the practice of meditation and is very much explanatory of what we do here. So in a certain sense, it's also a good place to jump into things. Because the Tibetan practice is very rich in many aspects, but one thing that runs through a lot of Tibetan practices is the visualization of images of the Buddha or Buddhas, and then the identification of oneself with that image. And literally beginning with imagining the Buddha or a Buddha outside of oneself and then merging with it as a way of evoking those characteristics of oneself. So there are many images of Buddhas. There are female Buddhas, there are male Buddhas, there are fierce Buddhas, there are peaceful Buddhas. These are all different aspects of the same consciousness of enlightenment expressing itself in our experience, if you will, in different ways. So when one visualizes oneself in one of those forms, what the intention is to evoke those qualities, essentially. So why does one visualize oneself as a female who's stepping off of a meditation cushion? And the symbolism is that the female aspect of oneself is more compassionate. Stepping off the meditation cushion is indicative of engaging in the world rather than being withdrawn from it. Okay. Why does one meditate on oneself as a Buddha who's holding a flaming sword over the head? Well, historically, all over the world, the symbol of a flaming sword is a symbol of wisdom, which cuts through illusion and sees things as they are. So there's some deep way in which the symbols evoke understandings that we have out of what Jung would call the collective unconscious, or what we might call our common culture. Because we're exposed to these images even as children in fairy tales and whatnot, and they have a deep impact on us. I mean, as an example of that, I remember when I was a graduate student, I had a great revelation, which was, why was it when I listened to certain pieces of music, certain bits of classical music, I had these weird images in my mind, which I couldn't identify? Like, why would I be listening to such and such a thing and see dancing hippopotami or hippopotamuses? Well, I went to see the Walt Disney movie Fantasia when I was a graduate student, which I hadn't seen since I was a kid. And here's all this classical music and dancing hippopotami or hippopotamuses or elephants and whatnot in tutus. And it's like that stuff had gotten into my subconscious, and I couldn't listen to that anymore without seeing these images. Well, so this stuff is in our minds, you know, and all of this imagery is meant to evoke it. And the fact that it's imagery from Asia is completely irrelevant in this particular case. I mean, there are some things that are not real well shared culturally, but there's some things that are very well shared culturally. Now, that's kind of an external, or what you might call an exoteric explanation of why one meditates on images. But there's a deeper meaning, and the third mindfulness explanation in the text actually gets at the deeper meaning. And the deeper meaning is that when you meditate in this way, it actually releases internal energies, for lack of a better word. The Tibetans call them winds. But when you meditate on yourself in the image of a Buddha, it actually releases inner energies that are dormant within you. And this is true. I mean, you experience it when you do it. I don't know any obvious way to explain it. You just find that it is true. And in the text, it says, you generate the image of yourself as a Buddha as a blissful entity. This is this technical language that I'm talking about. And what the idea is that when you visualize yourself as a Buddha, and we'll practice this way later this evening, when you visualize yourself as a Buddha in some form, Shakyamuni or any other, you know, the mind gets focused and it gets stabilized. And when that happens, it gets buoyant and elevated. And when it gets buoyant and elevated, that kind of releases energy that's typically kind of wandering around. Your attention wanders here, there, and the other place. It gets focused, and it's kind of held internally, and it's kind of channelized, if you will, for lack of a better term. And it does make you lighter. And if you're able to concentrate on these kind of images for any extensive period of time, you find your energy level rises. And the traditions of meditation say that when you can hold your attention on something for a relatively long period of time, you begin to feel an inner kind of peace or an inner kind of joyousness just from holding your mind still for a period of time. I mean, I think some of us have had the experience of not being driven crazy by our own brains and our own minds, and how peaceful and wonderful that is. And actually, you do feel kind of nice when that happens. And so this is an amplification of that. And if you can, and what happens is that with that amplification, that joy becomes the basis for wanting to hold your mind on the joy. Because although there are distractions, still that inner joy is something that you like to experience. So the tendency to be to have the mind be distracted is sort of mitigated by the fact of that joy. And so basically what you have is what used to be called a positive feedback loop, or I think another word for it is a feedback loop, which is an amplifying feedback loop, which is probably a better word than a positive feedback loop, where the more you're focused, the more you feel joy, and the more you feel joy, the more you're focused. And they reinforce each other, and they get stronger and stronger. And so when the text talks about generating the mind as a blissful entity in the form of a Buddha, this is what it's talking about. Because the longer you can concentrate the mind on this image, the more energetic and joyful and, in fact, blissful the mind becomes. And the more energetic and joyful and blissful the mind becomes, the more you can keep it concentrated. And so you have this amplifying feedback loop that's developed. So that's nice. But so what? What's the point? I mean, it's nice to be able to sit peacefully and joyfully and maybe even beatifically, but the Buddhists would say, but that's so what? That's kind of like, well, yeah, but you could drink a half a quart of vodka and feel good too. So what? You know, what is the point? Well, there's a practicality to this. And the practicality to this is that when you get the mind so insistently, energetically focused in this one-pointed way, then you deploy it, you use it. And you use it as an analytic tool to look at the nature of reality. So the whole reason for doing this is not merely, and I say the whole reason is not merely, let me rephrase this. The reason for doing this practice is not merely to evoke the qualities of oneself as a compassionate being or as a wise being. Those are good things. Those are beneficial things. Those change the internal habits. They change the way we relate to people in the world. But that's not the whole point. Because when one can generate that kind of focused mind, then one deploys it for the purposes of understanding the nature of reality. And the reason for doing this is that the Buddhist path is about getting out of the predicament that we're in. Now, the predicament we're in involves a lot of stuff. It involves treating other people as different than ourselves, as irrelevant to ourselves, as we don't care about them, as I'm not connected to them, a lot of delusionary kind of ideas which need to be addressed. But the fundamental problem is that we have an incorrect way of perceiving the reality that we're in. And all those things that I just described are symptoms of it. They're not the source, they're the symptoms. So the fact that people can think that they can become happy by doing things that make other people miserable, like certain kinds of financial type people, for example, is the symptom of a fundamental misunderstanding of what it means to be a human being. It's not in itself I mean, it, everything is a cause and a consequence of things, but it's not the fundamental problem. The fundamental problem is a certain level of misunderstanding which pervades everything. And so the fourth mindfulness, which is what you actually do in meditation practice once you've generated the mind in this focused way, is about addressing that fundamental problem. So Kay was just saying that I spent a lot of time talking about emptiness and that the other side of emptiness is interdependence. And when we move from talking about the four mindfulnesses to talking about Buddhism and ecology, we're kind of moving from, in the way I'll teach about it, we're moving from talking about the philosophy of emptiness to the other side of the coin, which is the philosophy of how everything interdepends. And in meditation practice, actually the same process is something that we engage with, because the idea is, and you see there are two stanzas for the fourth mindfulness. One stanza is the stanza that's associated with what do you do on the meditation cushion, and one stanza is associated with what do you do when you get up off of the meditation cushion and you're dealing with what's going on in the world, and which is an interesting problem, because when you talk with most people who are interested in meditation practice or spirituality, one of the problems they deal with is, well, this is what life demands of me, but this is what my inner life demands of me, and how do I reconcile the two becomes a difficult issue. So the fourth mindfulness really addresses how do you reconcile those two issues. And the Buddhist prescription, at least the Tibetan Buddhist prescription, at least the seventh Dalai Lama's prescription, is that the way you recognize them, the way you reconcile them, is on the meditation cushion you generate your mind in the form of a Buddha so that it's focused and blissful, and that blissfulness makes the mind concentrated, and then you use that concentrated mind to look at the nature of phenomena. And when you're meditating and you look at the nature of phenomena, you're looking at the true nature of phenomena, which is their underlying nature rather than their apparent nature. And their underlying nature is that they have no nature at all, that they're utterly transitory, as the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra says. They're like foam, they're like bubbles, they're like lightning flashes. They come and go. Which isn't to say they don't exist. A lightning flash exists, but it's gone. A bubble exists, but it's gone. But we don't see things this way. And so the practice of meditation, this practice of meditation, is to look at things as they actually are, which is mentally constructed, impermanent, constantly changing, here now, gone now, fully dependent upon my own ideas about what they are, and not dependent upon, as entities, not dependent upon anything else but that. So I'm not going to go into great detail about this because I have in a whole lot of other talks. But the flip side to this, then, is when you get up off the meditation cushion, you're no longer meditating yourself as a Buddha, because now you're brushing your teeth. Although you could meditate yourself as a Buddha brushing your teeth. We have had, Kay and I have had teachings about doing that sort of thing. But it can be a little bit confusing. And you can get a bit distracted, you know, like you're driving down the street and you're meditating yourself as a Buddha and you miss the stoplight or something. I mean, you've got to be practical about being, you know, right here and taking care of business. But the way you do that is by remembering what you experience when you're meditating, even though you're not in that state. And so how do you remember that? Well, you remember that what you're looking at is what the Buddhists call something like a magic show. It's like, oh, you just remember that nothing is what it appears to be. It appears to be what it appears to be, but it's not really what it appears to be. It's like a magician's conjuring. Now, you can't see what's behind a magician's conjuring. That's the way the magic works. Now, the text says, at the crossroads of the six consciousnesses and appearance, as I recall, something like that. And what that means, the six consciousnesses are our sense consciousnesses and what we're perceiving. At that crossroads, blah, 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 blah. Well, in ancient India, and this is where this comes from, in ancient India, you know, conjurers or magicians would set up at a crossroads, probably in medieval Europe too. They set up at a crossroads and do their show. And people would come and they'd see their show, and then they would pay the magician with, I don't know, a handful of rice or chicken or whatever it was, you know. And what the magician would do is he would make people see things that weren't there. And in the Buddhist stories, they say he'll take a stick, and he'll throw a stick up in the air, and he so hypnotizes the crowd that what they see is not a stick in the air, but they see a horse flying through the air. Just a horse walking down the road wouldn't be a big deal. But a horse in the air is a big deal. But it's not a horse in the air, it's a stick. But what they see is a horse in the air because they're hypnotized. And the idea is we are all hypnotized by ourselves, okay? And so we don't see what's really going on because we've managed to hypnotize ourselves. We are our own magicians. Now, the way, though, that they penetrate into this way of thinking about things is very interesting, because they ask the question, what does the magician see? Okay. The magician also sees a horse flying through the air, but the magician knows it's a stick because he's the one that created the magic act. But he sees a horse, but he knows it's a stick. So they say, be like the magician as you're going through daily life, remembering that you've conjured the appearance of this, being solid when it's transitory, independent of you when it's dependent upon you. Be like the magician who knows that what you see is not what's really there. Don't be like the crowd watching the magic show who really thinks there's a horse flying through the air. That's everybody else around who doesn't know about spiritual life and just believes in the material world as it is what it is. Now, even scientists, really, when you get right down to it, modern scientists would be like magicians, because they know that what they see isn't what's there, except most of the time they don't think about it, right? But a spiritual practitioner wants to think about that because they understand the implications of recognizing that what appears to be isn't what is. The implications being that it changes your behavior toward other people, toward the environment, and so on and so forth, right? Now, but that's not enough, because the Buddhists go one step farther in regards to this crossroads metaphor. They say, look, the magician has done this conjuring act and he's hypnotized the crowd. But what if some farmer were to come along after the show has started? Like, you know, the crowd is a bunch of farmers, okay? What if some farmer were to come along after the show has started? So the farmer was never hypnotized. What would the farmer see? What would the non-hypnotized person see? He'd see a stick in the air. So he would see what the magician doesn't see. And he would wonder, what the heck is the big deal going on around here that everyone's like, wow, look at that. All he sees is a stick flying through the air. He doesn't see a horse flying through the air. So the enlightened person, or the meditator sitting on the meditation cushion, sees the stick. So really, when you're sitting on the cushion, you're not even the magician, right? You're the freed person who has never been involved in the conjuring process. That's the goal of sitting on the meditation cushion. But it's not the goal of being in the world, because when you're in the world, you have to deal with the illusions. And from a compassionate point of view, if all you ever saw was the stick, why would you care about what's going on for anybody else, or even be able to relate to anybody else who sees a horse? Like, what horse? What's going on? You know, it's like you couldn't even have a relationship with those people because you would live in such a different space. But that's okay on the meditation cushion, right? And these two reinforce each other, they say, so that what you learn from being on the meditation cushion about the nature of the emptiness of reality, that strengthens your ability to see this as an illusion, as a magician's conjuring. And the more you see this as a magician's conjuring, the stronger your meditation will be on the actual nature of reality, that they reinforce each other. The definition of a Buddha, by the way, is somebody who brings those two things together in one moment and can see both the illusion and the reality at the same time. Mm-hmm. See, like a double exposure of a stick and a horse. You know, like when we, when photographs used to be taken with on paper with chemicals, mm-hmm. and sometimes you take two exposures on one, mm-hmm. you get a double exposure. I think that this metaphor is not going to work for young people anymore. Mm-hmm. But but for those of us old fogies who used to take pictures with cameras that had film in them, we understand what a double exposure is. A Buddha really has a double exposure view of reality. He sees what's truly there, and he sees the delusion that everybody else sees at the same time. And that's why being a Buddha is the ideal condition for benefiting all beings. And that's the reason for the vow, the Bodhisattva vow of becoming enlightened to benefit all beings. Because if you only saw what they saw, you couldn't help them. But the only way to help them is to see what's really there. But if you only see what's really there, you can't be in relationship with them because you have no basis for the relationship with ordinary beings when you're in that space of reality. So if you're in both spaces at the same time, the space of reality and delusion at the same time, then you can benefit beings. So the ideal eco-bodhisattva, if you will, right, the ideal being who works to benefit the environment is the being who can see what's really going on and see what other people see at the same time. Because when you see what they see and you're in the reality they're in, you can communicate with them. But if you see what's really going on, you also see what's wrong with the reality they're in, so you can change that reality and their relationship with it. And that would be then the basis for ecological practice in Buddhism. So that's my segue from the past into the future, from the four mindfulnesses into talking about Buddhism and ecology. Yes?
Bring up the technical language of the two truths just a little bit.
Well, that is, okay, yeah, but that is the two truths. The two, well, okay, the technical language of the two truths that Kay is referring to is that of conventional reality or relative reality on the one hand and ultimate reality on the other hand, and seeing the actual nature of emptiness of everything and that there's nothing there, nothing in the sense of no thing, not in a nihilistic sense of nothing, but in the sense of impermanence and also insubstantiality. That's the ultimate truth of things. And the relative or conventional truth of things is not seeing the way people see reality as such, not seeing the deluded reality, but seeing the real conventionality of things, which is the way all appearances interrelate with each other. That's why it's two truths. The other thing is delusion. What people see conventionally, I shouldn't use that language, what people see in an ordinary sense is just delusion. What the Buddha sees as conventional truth is the way appearances truly relate to each other. And the ultimate truth is that all those appearances have no substantial nature. They're empty of a substantial nature. Which is not to say, and I stress it's not a nihilistic view, because the non-substantial nature of everything is a certain type of nature that you can't identify. You can't identify it because as soon as you identify it, you've given it the limited characteristics of conventional reality. Right? So there is something there. It's usually referred to by the Buddhists as something like the clear light or the ultimate nature of phenomena or that or suchness. You know, they point at it. In Tantra, in meditation practice, they say that you experience that nature at the moment of death. But mostly you don't know it, right? Because at the moment of death, you're not conscious enough to know it. But if you think about the way death is described, at least in Buddhist language, death is the serial collapse of all the complex systems of the mind-body complex. And when those things fully collapse and there's nothing left, what's left? Well, what's left is not different than the essential nature of reality. Okay, so I can only talk about it in these kind of circumlocution negative ways, and sort of like, because how else are you going to talk about it? And anyhow, this isn't a class on death. But since Kay brought the issue up, there it is. Is that good enough?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just help the technical language be clear.
Well,
and they see that in books
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah, it's called the Two Truths. And the Buddhist Two Truths principle is very interesting because it avoids turning the world of human beings and life into something that's irrelevant when you're engaged in spiritual practice. I mean, one of the things that happens in a lot of sort of spiritual systems or religious experience or religious systems is there's a kind of God is real, everything else isn't. Well, this isn't God, so this doesn't matter. This being what's going on around us here. This isn't God, so this doesn't matter. And, you know, that leads to trashing the world. It leads to trashing each other. It leads to not caring. And it leads to unwholesome relationship with one's own body. And there are a lot of things that come out of that kind of attitude, or could come out of that kind of attitude. The teaching of the Two Truths negates that because it says, no, this is real in a certain way. But it's not irrelevant because it is real in a certain way. And the other thing is real in another way, but it's not the end of the story, even though it's sort of more real than the other thing. They're both truths. It doesn't say, the two truths theory doesn't say that there's ultimate truth and conventional truth, and the ultimate truth is capital T truth, and conventional truth is lower T truth. It says they're both capital T truth. That's why Buddhism is called non-dualism also. But it gets at the issues often by using the negative. Because if you use the positive, then you're identifying something as something. And as soon as you do that, you've lost it. Because reality is something that's not identifiable for all the reasons we just got through talking about. I'm going to go down this rabbit hole, and it's going to be a problem. So, I don't want to do that. So, are there questions about what I've talked about this evening?
Or comments?
No. Well, then we can have tea.
Well, just give them a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just thinking you explained very well because it would be so easy to go into a kind of cynicism and just say if everything is illusory anyway, why not trash the planet?
And that is absolutely true. It is a problem, and it is possible. And I mean, if you think about India, and you think about sort of the world rejecting attitude of many yogis in India, you know, not just from the point of view of, well, I want to lead a simple life so I have no distractions, so I can be focused on my spiritual life, but much more along the lines of negating the value of the world. I mean, that's the outcome that you're talking about. And we don't even have to go into, I can just say, and then think about Christianity. Don't have to go into any detail about that. And, you know, well, I will, you know, rejection of the feminine, because rejection of the body and those things are so associated with each other, rejection of the value of the world. You know, not all Christians do this. I mean, think of St. Francis. I mean, obviously he didn't. But there's a strong tendency to go in that direction. And if you think of the early church, with, you know, at the time of the martyrs, you know, you're looking at that in a real serious way, where it's kind of like a serious rejection of the so-called material world, whatever they called it. You're right. It's very important teaching in Buddhism. Very important.
Well, that's since you brought up Christianity, I was, when you were talking about the magician and the crowds and everything, I was thinking about the New Testament descriptions of Jesus and the crowds, and, you know, turning water into wine, and loaves and fishes,
exactly.
and, you know, curing the sick and things like that, which I'm not, what I'm grasping to understand is that, I mean, I'm willing to believe that all that was just made a convenient story that got lots of converts to Christianity, but I'm also willing to believe that there was a human being that had some kind of window into, I mean, kind of like the magician you're talking about, that was like, well, okay, I see what's going on here, here's all these people here, and like anything, it's easy once you know how. And maybe the challenge is not to do it all the time because it's so much fun. But anyway, I was thinking
that's interesting. Maybe that's what he was doing.
Well, actually, yeah, there's been a study of
maybe that. He could see both realities, mm-hmm. like that's what you're describing here.
I think somebody has studied that in the context of magic in the Middle East at that time, and there was a tradition of illusory magic and illusionists, uh-huh. and indeed he might well have been caught up in that. I think so. You know, I think that's
I mean, when I share the Indian story, I mean, because this comes from Indian Buddhism, even though it gets carried forward into the Tibetan world. I mean, the Buddhists tell the story as a metaphor. You know, they're not saying that there really were people walking around throwing sticks in the air and people saw horses. But there may have been people throwing sticks in the air and people saw horses. But the Dalai Lama is not specifically saying that happened. He's saying, well, we can understand this story. But maybe it did really happen. I mean, it's kind of amazing what people do and don't understand and do and don't see. I mean, there was an article in the current issue of The New Yorker, right, on a pickpocket. Okay, so bear with me. On a pickpocket who does a show in Las Vegas. And his show is all about how he can do things that you don't believe are possible. But the way he does it, and he then explains this to he does seminars for law enforcement people and Department of Defense and whatnot, is he distracts people's attention. He distracts people's attention so they don't see what he's doing. And he talks about very simple things like, you know, how do you enter a person's personal space? And if you enter their space in one way, they recoil. But if you enter their space in another way, you actually distract their attention. And when their attention is distracted over here, your hand can go over there. And if you're light-handed, they don't notice that something's come out of their pocket because their attention is going. And he talks about the way in which people's attention is actually so controllable if you understand how to do it. And he understands how to do it very well. Mm-hmm. So then you go back to the question of what was happening at the crossroads. Well, I don't know what was happening at the crossroads. But people are very distractible, and people are surprisingly non-conscious of what's going on around them, so who knows what's possible and not, especially if you're not one of those non-conscious people. I'm not one of those non-conscious people, so I don't know how to do this stuff, but I can sort of imagine the possibilities. And you think of somebody like Jesus, who must have been incredibly conscious. You know, what was he capable of? Whether it was sleight of hand or real magic, I don't know. I mean, reality, if we know that reality isn't what we think it is, who knows what's possible? Right. Because it's sort of like, you know, who was it that was in the Bush administration that was... He had a hard time in the media because he said they're the unknowns. Then there are the unknowns that we know are unknown. Then there are the unknowns that we don't know. And everyone said, what? Rumsfeld. He's like, what the hell is he talking about? Actually, what he was talking about was pretty smart. It's sort of like, there's the stuff we know, there's the stuff we know we don't know, and then there's probably stuff out there we don't even know we don't know.
Exactly.
That's very rational, but it's too rational for the media, of course. So I'm saying, you know, there's what we see, and we know what we see isn't real, so what does that open the door to? I don't know.
Yeah.
Loaves and fishes? Why not?
I was just going to say, I think there is the real possibility that you could be full with a very small bit of any of those things. If it was given, in this real giving way, and that there you were sharing it and having this incredible experience that was very uplifting, that you could be full from
just
a
tiny
or
a
any
a
of
tiny
those kind
amount.
Of things. I mean, I think there's so many different ways that you could look at that, but it seems like it, you know, that the possibilities are.
Well, I think of your experience when you were really sick in India. In fact, when she talks about
that's
that,
true.
I mean, we were
almost died in India during one of our retreats that we did, and I won't go into the details of the illness, but didn't eat anything for several days, and then when I finally did, it was like an incredible purge, and then when I finally did, it was like I could eat three peas, and I could feel the energy of each of them, and it was enough. So it was kind of, it was mind-blowing, really. So it's just, it's just, I'd forgotten about that, but it's just like what you're talking about, really. Yeah.
I haven't forgotten about it.
There's a lot of stories in places, like in Tibet, too, where, you know, if your perception of reality includes the fact that there's, everything is impermanent and changing and made of light and made of small particles and this and that, you know, where people have, you know, great yogis that put their hands into rock and left imprints and stuff like that. So, or pulled, you know, holy beings in India too that can, you know, manifest things out of the ether, like food and, you know, incense and flowers and things like that too. That I don't think is sleight of hand. I can't think of his name anymore. It was the same.
Sai Baba.
Sai Baba, yeah. He used to be able to do some of that too. So I don't think that's out of the question either. It seems like it fits in with that idea that, I mean, if you have enough realization that you can, and a lot of the cities that they talk about in Tibet and Buddhism too, like being able to travel vast distances really fast, like almost like when you're walking, they see them walking like above the earth a little bit, and they move really fast, and being able to, you know, be very small or be very large, you know, there's just a lot of things that seem to go along with once you have your perception of reality isn't kind of locked into a box, and is more permeable, that these kind of things arise, though they aren't the final goal. You know, there's a lot more, you know, the goal is to become a Buddha so that you can help other beings. But
it seems that the danger in what Brian is talking about is when an interpretation is branded as truth.
Exactly. Yeah.
This is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And end of story.
Right.
And how can you leave it there?
Right.
It takes a lot of reinforcement and theologies built to reinforce it, to sustain it.
Right.
And then I think you get so far away from what we're talking about. The two truths. Instead, you have one truth with a capital T.
Right.
And the mind isn't to question and understand what else might be involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's totally right.
Yeah.
Creation
but
of a story.
Yeah.
Big story.
Yeah. And I don't think all of us could agree what's happened here right now.
Right.
Could what?
Could all of us agree what's happened here
right
now? I mean, there it, is, you know, it's about truth and reality and how everything works is just so, it is that there are two things going on at least all the time for all of us, but you know, depending on where you are. I like to think of Christ as a Buddha. Christ is a Buddha. I mean, he was a Buddha. That's my opinion. I like that.
Well, you know, if you
he has been captured and fixed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
if
in an interpretation
that
you have to believe that interpretation, or you're on the outside.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
there's so many. Religion is so
it's big,
right. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to say. It's sad that, you know, Christianity is so far removed from Christ. I mean, the what would Jesus do thing even though it seemed amusing at the time. But boy, do I ever wish.
Nice, it would be nice to know sometimes, wouldn't it?
I guess it would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm just saying.
No, be careful. If we get a visit from him, it means the world's going to end, doesn't it? Speaking of rigid theology.
Just for them to ask themselves, what would Jesus do? Would they, like, stone somebody to death because they had been raped or something? Or would they condemn, or would they kill abortion doctors? I mean, is that what Jesus would do? No. But if more Christians would do what they could imagine Jesus would do, then I think we'd be all a lot mellower.
This, you know, you were saying, well, I think that Jesus was a Buddha. It's interesting. So, you're extracting the idea of Jesus from sort of the rigid Christian notion of what Jesus is. But it's very interesting to extract the Buddha from the rigid Buddhist notion of what Buddha was. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, we think of Buddha in the context of Buddhism. But if you think of Buddha in the context of the Enlightenment principle or the spiritual mm-hmm. principle or the God principle or whatever you want to call it, then to say, oh, well, was Jesus a Buddha? Was Buddha a Christ? I mean, the language becomes very, you know, not very useful, because what we're talking about is, I believe what we're talking about, is beings who have gotten to the place of understanding the reality of what's going on. And whether we call them Christs or Buddhas or whatever, you know, but it's kind of like, it's easy to fall into, well, the Buddha's real, but Christ is, he was just a Buddha. He wasn't really what they say he was a Buddha. Well, you have to be careful that you don't fall into the, well, the Buddha's just the Buddha. I mean, because, you know, Buddhas say he was the Buddha. We know what a Buddha is. Well, no, we don't. It's like, what is that? You understand what I'm saying when I say all of this? It's easy to fall into the same kind of semi-fundamentalist attitude in the Buddhist context as in any other context. That's what I'm trying to say.
Can we all believe that? I mean, I can be a Buddha.
Yes.
You know, I haven't ever thought
that's the
that
difference.
I could be a Christ.
Right, that's the difference between.
But then there are Christians who do, you know.
Yeah, who do.
Right, that is
a
difference.
They're saying they're Christ, but they do understand that that's the. That they're
Christ
trying to develop
nature,
the Christ nature inside themselves.
I mean, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So there
is right.
that. But I think they're both enlightened.
Yeah.
That,
I mean,
it, from historical perspective, I don't know anything about either one of them. But history would lead you to believe that they both had certain qualities of enlightenment.
Yeah, I mean, that would make the most sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Right. It is true that in the Christian tradition, it would be a problem to say that I'm practicing so I can become Christ. Whereas in the Buddhist tradition, it is a given that you will say, I'm practicing so I can be Buddha. They are different. Yes, they are different in that respect. They are different in that respect. I'm not trying to say that your traditions are the same. But what I am trying to say is one wants to free oneself from potentially fundamentalist ways of thinking about the Buddhist tradition also. And it's easy to fall into them. It's like, this is right, that's wrong, this makes sense, that doesn't. Mm-hmm. Well, that can only be described by this. Mm-hmm. My tradition describes all of that stuff over there, but your tradition doesn't describe mine. Yeah. Well, that's really dangerous.
It is, yeah.
That's dangerous. Really dangerous, and not a good place to go to.
And the two truths doesn't fit into that.
The two truths rejects that idea completely.
Right.
We have Netflix streaming, so I watched this show that was called The Gospel According to Judas.
Mm.
And let's see. So they think that there were like 20 Gospels, and that the early fathers of the church said, this is too confusing, we like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, this will do. And anyway, the Gospel of Judas, there was this papyrus remnant of it, and they looked at it and all that. And the short, pertinent piece of it is that supposedly Judas was, rather than the villain of the Bible story that mm-hmm. he's been made out to be, and actually they traced it on down the line to anti-Semitism, particularly in Germany, where Judas and Judan are very similar.
Mm.
That Judas was actually a favorite apostle of Jesus,
mm-hmm.
and that shortly before Jesus was killed, that Judas was having these intense dreams, including one that he was being stoned to death by the rest of the apostles. And that, and in this gospel, it gives an account where Jesus is basically saying to Judas, you know, what the spirituality is all about is looking inward. And it was like a very Buddhist-like message.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
as I was hearing this. And anyway, I found that very interesting. And you know, the question looms large, you know, what did happen to Judas afterwards, you know, but basically Jesus was saying, this is the role you have to play, and this is like a really honorable role, and you're the one that gets to do it, and he's like, well, geez, thanks, you know.
Well, you know, it's, but that's similar to, you know, in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know,
yeah.
Jesus says, can this cup pass from me? I don't want to have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Can somebody else do this, please?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like this yeah. this same process. Like, no, you got to have to do this, I'm afraid. Okay, I'm going to do it. Okay, Judas, you're going to have to do this. No, I don't want. Yeah, you're going to have to do this. Someone's got to.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You have the devotion to me that you will do this. Maybe that's what the deal is. I don't know. I'm no Christian scholar.
I've read years ago. I studied a lot more of the Gnostic Gospels. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's very fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
Take
you
totally outside of
yeah.
that. What's that author? Elaine.
Elaine Hagel.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's written on this exactly.
Right. Oh yeah, she's
yeah.
a ton.
Yeah.
Excellent book on.
She's very
yeah.
fun to read. To get
yeah.
outside of that fundamental sort of way of looking at things,
mm.
she's
yeah.
just a blast.
Yeah.
yeah. She also helps remind us that they did not throw out the mystics in some of these gospels
right,
because
absolutely.
They were confusing, but they wanted to construct a theological framework where these certain early church leaders had control.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a determinant for what was excluded and what was put in.
Yeah, there was a purpose behind the editing process.
A big right. purpose.
It usually
yeah.
is.
Yeah. Heavy-handed editing.
Yeah. What was that?
It was heavy-handed.
Heavy-handed editing.
Yeah, it was pretty
and
intense.
And the elimination of the role of women.
Of women,
oh,
absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
even in the painting, The Last Supper, I swear that person next to Jesus is female.
It is.
I guess it was the.
It's Mary.
Well, Bagels argues that.
Yeah. It's
yeah,
Mary.
Bagels writes about, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I tried to show that to my Christian friend who was an artist. Oh, no.
I would enjoy it in the moment.
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, none of this is of interest to fundamentalist Christians.
No, definitely not. That's heresy.
Very threatening.
Yeah.
Heresy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Burden
at the stake.
A conversation like this